It's my pleasure to welcome Jody Myers.
Thank you for having me, and it's a pleasure to be here. I've spoken before at the synagogue on my main area of research, which has been messianic ideas, religious Zionism. And I'm trained as a historian, and most of my research was on modern religious thought, religious Zionism. But I had a sabbatical in 1999, and I'm a professor at Cal State University, Northridge, and all that means then is one semester where I don't have to teach. And because I have a few kids and a husband, and only had a semester off, I couldn't go and do research in far-off places, and I was more interested in seeing what's happening in LA, especially in issues. I found there's a lot of greater interest in purity issues, people being more and more kosher, being more and more concerned about glot meat as opposed to other types of kashrut, not being able to eat romaine lettuce, things like that. Issues even of purity that came in terms of conversion. In terms of conversion and whether someone converted or not. Stuff like that. So I thought, you know, this is an issue in my neighborhood. I live in the like Pico Robertson area. And so I thought, why not look at these new manifestations of purity? And I had examples of, one of the things that intrigued me was these people wearing white. There are these American-born Sikhs wearing white on Robertson by Airdrome, and then the people at the Kabbalah Center. And that really intrigued me. Those are men and boys wearing white on Shabbat only. And everyone is in an uproar about the Kabbalah Center. My rabbi said, don't go there. I'm counseling people against it because it's been destroying families. And I had friends whose husbands went off the deep end there and also wrecked their marriages. And my colleagues, academic scholars of Kabbalah, said, this is just such a scam. And it's illegitimate. Don't even look at it because you'll be legitimizing it. So I decided to do it because I felt it was really intriguing. It's gotten such an uproar. And why else do I have this profession of religious studies if not to study these new phenomena? And I just couldn't figure out what are these young, hip-looking Americans gathering around the Kabbalah Center. What I knew about Kabbalah, which wasn't that much, I wasn't training in it in terms of my academic studies. What I learned about it was how much it, my word would be, it's almost demonized women, women's blood, menstrual period, and they were so off limits. And same thing with non-Jews, that there's this stark contrast between the pure and the impure within Kabbalah. And so I was really interested, how were these ideas transformed to make them palatable? What kind of change had been making? So I really came to it personally just interested because there it was in my neighborhood, but also interested from the perspective of a scholar. And also just being very mindful of how hard it is to perpetuate Judaism to our children. And to make people stay in synagogues and these more conventional forms of Judaism, what was the Kabbalah Center doing to draw people into its service, which is all in Hebrew, which has separate men and women section, and a machitza down the middle, a division, and a full Torah reading? I mean, what were they doing? So that's why I embarked on the study. I just did it casually first, and by 2004 I decided I might as well just get this off my desk already and do a full-blown study. And so I used my history training to look at the evolution of the ideas over time and from Kabbalah, but also within the past about 30 years of Kabbalah Center's existence, or 40 years actually. And then I also did interviews, a lot of interviews with people, and I hung around and I participated. And that's a method from anthropology, the field of religious studies, that when you're studying a religious group, you can't just look at them from afar. You sort of hang among them and talk with them. And that way, it fleshes out what you think you know just from what's written.
Okay, so I have a lot of questions. Starting with, was your impression that what they were teaching, the only direct exposure that I had to the Kabbalah Center was to read Michael Berg's book, which was, I don't remember what it was called, something like Your God, I'm God, and He's God too.
Becoming God.
Becoming God. I thought it's no secret because I reviewed it for the Jewish Journal. I thought it was a terrible book. But aside from the fact that I thought the ideas weren't very compelling, what struck me about it was completely denuded of anything Jewish. Talmud's never mentioned, Torah's never mentioned. When he quotes a rabbi from the Talmud, he calls him a Kabbalist instead of saying that he's a rabbi or a Talmudist. So it surprises me to hear that they have, for example, a full Torah reading. Is someone walking in the Kabbalah Center impressed with the Jewishness of the Kabbalah Center? How Jewish is it?
Okay, well, if they're going to walk in there, they're going to see a lot of Hebrew. Are they going to know that's Jewish? I think they're not going to know it's not English. I mean, so do they associate that? So it's not imprinted. This is a Jewish service. This prayer book, which you're going to be using, is based on and is a liturgy that comes from Isaac Luria. And it's not said explicitly, but it's not said we're opening the Torah and all Jewish synagogues around the world are opening the Torah on this day. And yes, there are ways to differentiate what they're doing from others in a certain subtle way sometimes. Remember, there's a Torah portion in the summer, which has, in Deuteronomy, which has the blessings and curses. If you follow these laws, you're blessed, and if not, you're cursed, and there's a whole lot of curses. And they emphasized one day when I was there doing that service that you have to read it just right. You have to read, this word is written this way, but you have to say it this way. Now, as a scholar, I know there's ketiv and kri, there's the way it's written and then the way it's pronounced in certain special words. But they also said, you know, not all synagogues do this, and not all places in the world do this, only a few special places do it right. And we're one, you know, only those that know Kabbalah, and it's important because otherwise when you read the curses, you actually put the curses upon yourself.
Well,
so. Yeah. In that sense, so a simple answer is, they don't sit there and say they're Jewish. They don't usually harp on it. In fact, they rarely even mention it. And then when I would read Michael Berg's book, I would absolutely agree with you. That was what was so interesting about starting with the beginning books from the 70s, because it's very clear in the beginning books. There's Rabbi Akiva, there's Torah, there's Judaism, there's Jewishness all over, from the 70s and the 80s. And when I come, and that was by Rabbi Berg, Rabbi Philip Berg, who's an ordained Orthodox rabbi. But what happens is, even in his books in the 90s, there's a change. It's the same ideas. I mean, they really haven't changed. It's just that the language is different.
To appeal to people not in the Jewish, do they say anything, for example, about Israel, about Jewish peoplehood, about any of those ideas?
Israel is very important. It still is today. Israel is the place where there's the most holiness. Israel comes up during the war in Lebanon, absolutely, there are prayers and meditations, but not the homeland of the Jewish people.
Because I still have a tape. VCR tape, so it's, you know, it's waning, but I still have a tape where Philip Berg claims credit for the Oslo Accords. They're due to his prayers. Now, I'm sure that he is not still reproducing that tape, but obviously in that tape, Israel's very important, so I wondered if...
It is important, and I would say that the most devout people at the center, those that are really following Jewish law the most, and that is the ideal, to do all of that, they're Israelis in LA. It's a very strong Israeli contingent, and the core leadership is Israeli. But it's not the type of American Zionism or the type of nationalism that we've had.
That we grew up with. I, too, have had more than one family, in fact, many families, come and complain about other members in the family who are in the Kabbalah Center. So I don't know exactly how to ask this question or a way in which you could answer it. I don't want to ask if they're a cult, because that's too amorphous a question. I don't know what a cult, how you define a cult, but do they, in some way, do you believe, either seek to extract a lot of money from people, or seek to separate them from people who disbelieve in it, or try to enmesh people so that their entire lives are all about the Kabbalah Center?
Well,
Let me ask it that way, because those are specifics.
Those are five questions.
They are. They are, but what I'm trying to do is, instead of saying, are they a cult, I'm trying to ask the things that tend to characterize cults and ask if they do those things, basically.
They believe very firmly that you should give money. You should give a tenth of your
income. I do too.
Right.
So that's not
right.
Right.
At least a tenth of your income to charity. They feel they're a very good charity. If you don't give your money to them, give it to another charity, but you better make sure that it's going to the cause, or a good cause, and not just to some administrator. Okay? When people come, and this belief is, you know, I would say based on old Jewish sources. You're supposed to give a tenth, tithing, right? Tithing. So they also will say tzedakah matzil mimavet, that when you give tzedakah, it saves you from death. Also, very old tradition. They really mean it in a very serious way, and believe that, let's say you come in distress, you have a terrible disease, you've tried all the chemo or whatever, and it's terminal, and they talk to you and find that you're actually a person who hasn't been giving a tenth of your money to charity. Well, that goes back to that they would say, well, look at your life. You've been given all this by God, and you're not giving back. You're remiss. You really have to give. Will it save you from death? Maybe not, but it will benefit you because you are held accountable for not doing this. Especially if you're Jewish, because Jews have this commandment of giving a tenth, non-Jews don't. So, is that using fear tactic? Yeah. So does Orthodoxy, for that matter. You know, I mean, we have a lot of fear in our religions.
So did you find anything in their practice that you felt was personally objectionable?
Personally, me?
Yes.
I mean, I don't believe it.
I understand, right.
But,
in other words, did you think anything crossed the line? Do you understand why it has the reputation it does? Is it different from the Orthodox synagogue down the street?
Well, here's the thing. I have to differentiate between what the ideas and beliefs are in a religion and whether the people running the church or synagogue are consistent with that. Okay? I mean, look at Catholicism. You know, priests aren't supposed to be pedophiliacs. They're not supposed to act on it. But they did. So does that damn all of Catholicism? I don't think so. I think it's really tragic. And it certainly drove people away. And I had to look at it. And I didn't sit and examine. I mean, I was in there a lot, so I didn't see. People didn't hit on me for money. People didn't even hit on me for buying a Zohar. And maybe that's because of the way I carry myself. Or, you know, I didn't walk around saying I'm a professor. I didn't say that at all. But of course there were people in there that were gossipy and nasty and so on and so forth. You have that everywhere. Did I find it more so? That's hard to quantify, not really. I heard lots of stories from people. I interviewed ex-members who would tell me things that people had said to them that were personally insulting because they had a different idea. I said this in the book, you know, I can't quantify how emotionally manipulating they are, and my sense is that they're as emotionally manipulative as all sorts of other religions, and how people respond to their ideas. So my book is not a statement of, you know, whether they're aggressive. Yeah, they're aggressive. New religious movements are aggressive. They've discovered the truth. They're new converts, and that's what you have with a new religious movement. This is new. They've seen the light. It's the first generation. It's exciting. It's dramatic. And so they get carried away. It's like a new convert sometimes. Not all new converts are like this, but people that are Baalei Tshuva, that have come back to Judaism, they get overly rigid. They are off-putting. They cut themselves off from their families. So then you get a whole lot of them in a room and in a community, and you're going to get that phenomenon. It doesn't mean that that's intrinsic to the ideas, and that's something I saw. It's not intrinsic to the ideas. In fact, they believe in missionizing their message. So what's intrinsic is that you have to be good and kind and generous, like God, to bring more people in.
And so what did you discover that you didn't expect to?
I was astounded that there was this ethical basis to it. Because I too read these books. When I came into the center, when I began researching, I had read the articles about the center, I had read some of the popular books, and I kept saying, oh brother, who can believe this stuff? And I found that that was a lot of their marketing, and that if you really stay into the classes and talk to the teachers and talk to the people who are more devoted, you found underneath all these mitzvot, and especially this real importance of treating people with human dignity. And I was blown away. I was like, what?
Right.
It really emphasizes all these good behavior. There's a book that Michael Berg wrote called Prosperity. And so it's how to make, you think in your mind, how to get prosperity. And then when you actually read it and you get past the style, which you don't like and I don't like, realize prosperity is not about making tons of money, but about getting more connected with God and feeling connected with the world better. And that they're convinced when you have this sort of wholeness and gentleness and generosity towards people, you will be prosperous. You will give money. If you give your 10%, you'll get more money. And I had read these sentiments in the writings of 19th century rabbis. When times were rough, they said, give more money. You'll make more.
And did you ask them about things like Kabbalah water?
Oh, yes.
And what did they say about it?
And in the book, I have a whole section on Kabbalah water. What's interesting about the Kabbalah water, in Judaism, we have the notion is water. You go in and suddenly you come out changed. Right? So I figured Kabbalah water is some type of form of mikvah water. But no. It's water from a pristine source. It's got to taste good. It's got to be really pure. And that means pure in terms of, pollution. Should it be free of pollution? And there's special Kabbalistic meditations that Rabbi Berg put into it to make it changed, to remove from it all the negativities that have accrued to all of our water, and that's not a pollution issue. It's remember at the beginning of creation, there was this pure water there, and God said it was good. But then by the time of Noah's flood, waters can be bad, it can kill people, so it can absorb people's own negativities. So the Kabbalah water is that pristine water of creation. And I know all the research on water and all these purified waters like that. There's no scientific basis for anything being changed in it when it's been meditated upon. And I would interview people, and I interviewed a pharmacist who's a devoted member of the Kabbalah Center, a pharmacist who knows how to examine water. And she accepted the word that this had been changed, that the water had been changed by the meditations, that somehow its pH was even different, but yet she never tested it. But she could tell me ways that it really helped her, and where it helped people who didn't even believe in it, in her own firsthand experience with one of her coworkers at the pharmacy. And what could I do? I'm a rational person. I don't accept scientific claims without seeing them tested. So it clearly doesn't convince me. But here's a community that doesn't care about my scientific verification. And it's also really not necessarily about science. Does mikvah water suddenly change someone who's not Jewish to Jewish?
That's different. Nobody says it's a scientific change. It seems to me, nobody says when you walk into the mikveh that if you test someone's body when they come out, it'll be scientifically different. I've never heard that from any rabbi. They say it changes you religiously, and it seems to me in some sense that you're giving up your ability to judge by being an academic. Where it seems to me that you ought to say to that pharmacist, test it. If you really are making a scientific claim that it's different, the way we know whether scientific claims are validated or not is by scientific testing.
She would say both things. She wouldn't just say science. She would say science, and she would say religiously.
Well,
she doesn't differentiate between them the way
But
I
the
do.
Religiously one, I can't argue with. But if she says the pH is different, we can actually tell.
Right, and I said, did you test it? She said no. And
but doesn't bother you in any way?
Sure, it bothers me. But okay. I'm not in a position to scold anyone. I'm in a position to say, what is it that you believe? And it was patently clear to me, and I said it. Anyone who wants scientific verification of their religion is not going to be comfortable at the Kabbalah Center and will not be in the Kabbalah Center. But when I'm doing my research, I'm not going to try to tell people to change their minds. I mean,
well, that's what I'm actually trying to get at, is you wrote a book not to evaluate their claims, but to explain their claims.
But you know, the evaluation
is... Is that true? I'm just asking if that's true.
I would say not to judge. I don't know.
Okay, I said evaluate.
Evaluate, judge, whatever. It's very clear. They don't care about the scientific verification. Their science is a bogus science. But they also conflate religion and science. That's what the New Age tends to do.
Right.
They, you know, you're not going to...
So if you ask them, for example, about evolution, they would say...
You know, I never asked about that. I don't know. What I did find,
well,
which was surprising, is about medical treatment. They're absolutely impressed with the best medical treatment. And with hospitals.
So there isn't faith healing the same way that there is.
What they do is, and this is something that also surprised me, because I've heard, you know, people go in there with terrible cancer and they give them Kabbalah water. It wasn't like that. It was, they're sent to the best, go to the doctor, get second opinions, check it out with your friends, but also, you better use Kabbalah water. You better give your tzedakah. You better do that too, because they work together. Because if you're just physically doing the cure in you, it's not lasting. It won't really work, because any disease is really spiritual.
Right.
It's a physical manifestation of a spiritual reality. It's because of something that you have done in either this life or past life. And again, you know, it's not something I believe in, but what am I going to tell people? Are you crazy? Do you really believe your sainted mother has this terrible disease because she didn't do, yes, you know, A, B, C? And they'll say, well, maybe she was really good, but in a past life. You know, in a past life. How else could it be? How else can you explain it? God doesn't give diseases, and there's nothing random. People, they believe very firmly everything that happens is from God. But God wouldn't give diseases. It's something you earn because of your behavior, and if not now, previous life.
Questions? Yeah.
I'd like to know what you think about Madonna. Mm-hmm. Period.
What do I think about Madonna? She's really interesting in terms of, you know, this is a really interesting example of how you got a celebrity who... And someone like Madonna, who I really never listened to before, and I don't really listen to her now. We are so fascinated in the society by celebrities that anything they do gets a sudden, incredible amount of press and publicity. And someone like Madonna is certainly good at getting it, and has been noted for her performances and her singing that's very anti-religion, certainly anti-Catholicism. Against patriarchy, against misogynism, against repression, and here comes Madonna, happens to like this. And for many people, well, if Madonna likes it, and you know what she thinks about oppressive religion, yeah, I'm going to take a second look.
Yeah, for many people, it's embarrassing.
For many people, it's embarrassing. Well, this is interesting. You know, I teach at Cal State Northridge, and when I was doing this research, I had a class. Jews, non-Jews, and I said, how many of you think that having Madonna pitch your religion is a good thing or a bad thing? All the Jewish students said overwhelmingly, oh, it's terrible. And the non-Jews were just astounded. They said, are you kidding? And they said, Madonna, and publicity, and you guys, everybody's hated you all these years and thinks Judaism is ridiculous, and here comes someone saying it's great and she's not even Jewish. Are you nuts? Right? And so that was really eye-opening for me.
Okay, yes. Okay, Ira?
I have 3-4 questions to be asked of all. First of all, when you say they do a Torah reading, do they do the same parsha as a traditional, you know, Reform conservative would do for the same?
Exactly the same parsha that we, that all the other synagogues do, but they do a full Torah reading.
I thought that only the introductory lecture you can get in, the rest is like a closed club there, and you had no problem going in.
Oh no, the introductory lectures, like I think a couple nights a week, they're free. They're like 45-minute sales jobs to get you to sign up for Kabbalah 1 and Kabbalah 2 and
which
Kabbalah
costs?
3.
Which costs?
Which costs? Well, when I did it, in, it was like a 10 sessions. Each session is about an hour and a half. It was $220.
For the 10 sessions?
Right. Maybe more now.
Go ahead, last.
Not that there's anything wrong, but wasn't one of the Bergs an insurance salesman before he got into this business?
Yes. Rabbi Berg, when he got ordained as a rabbi, that's not...
I spent 3 nights as a Fuller Brushman in high school. I don't want to run that.
I think lots of rabbis are in sales.
Yeah, right, exactly.
You know,
yes.
They're hustling Judaism, they're hustling insurance.
Go ahead.
I actually have a couple questions, too. I think part of the reason why Jews react about Madonna that way is because she didn't convert. She's, quote-unquote, practicing Judaism, which many people seem to be doing at the Kabbalah Center, aside from the Israelis, who aren't Jewish, which I think many Jews find offensive and troubling. So I'd like to know how you feel about that. And also, I wanted to ask about, you were talking about how sort of surprised you were that their basis for everything was sort of so ethical. My understanding is that it's very similar to Scientology in that the reason that they give for you to practice these ethical things is to elevate your own personal life. Whereas my personal experience with conservative Judaism, at least, is that you're a good person because it benefits the whole community and it benefits the whole world, not because it makes your life, not because you're going to get ahead in some way. So I'm kind of curious about those two things.
Okay, first of all, Scientology. I've studied Scientology. It's really not so much like, it's not the same. It's not even in the same class, I think. I mean, it's a new religious movement, everyone hates it. So that's what they have in common. And there's money involved. Now, I want you to, there's money in Judaism. Hello, look at this building, look at your capital campaign, look at your membership fees.
We have a big debt still. So. And by the way, how much did you pay this morning to come into this class? Nothing. Thank you. So.
I know that. I'm a member
of
the synagogue.
Of course.
Yeah. So I know right. All that. But my yearly dues and all other expenses,
right.
$3,000.
It's a lot of money.
Kabbalah Center doesn't have membership. There's no membership to back, and you know that membership doesn't support the synagogue. You need beyond membership to support the synagogue. So their feeling is you're going to pay for what you get. You want to go to class, you pay for the class. Partly that's fairer, but really it goes back to an older principle that there's no free thing. If you're going to get something,
but in what ways is it different from Scientology?
Because as far as I know in Scientology, when you get up to certain levels, you have to pay to get up to certain levels. That doesn't happen in the Kabbalah Center. I pay for classes. I went to Shabbat services free.
And you know, is the is
if,
there,
I, if I went to a meal, I would pay. So, the esotericism, there are certain teachings within Kabbalah that only the highest level can understand and learn and be taught. So in that sense, very, very few people in the center, probably in LA, maybe a couple of the teachers are at that level. So that's one question. But the comparison is done all the time. In terms of why are you doing these commands? Why are you doing these rituals? It's not to use the word commandments. Why meditate? Because they don't start you out with doing Shabbat. You're going to meditate on Hebrew letters and the Zohar and so on. Absolutely, they say it's going to make your life better. No question. And that's also part of, but it's part of the way they market it. Come in the door, it's going to make your life better. You're going to be happy, you're going to be prosperous. then, but as you're taught, is what involves happiness is partly being content with where you are and appreciating the people around you, being generous and giving and not being reactive. And that's a Scientology word. Not just letting your impulses carry you away and you do stupid things. That's one thing. But your first question was about
Conversion.
Conversion.
Not being Jewish.
You know, why it's a chapter in the book, why does it rule the subject, or why Madonna doesn't have to convert? And Madonna is not practicing Judaism. She absolutely denies that she's practicing Judaism. This is Kabbalah. And the idea is that doing these meditations, which is about just daily meditations, and some of the blessings before and after meals are getting up in the morning and washing your hands and saying the bracha netilat yadayim. That's considered a Kabbalistic meditation. So circumcision and all that type of stuff. The idea is, if people want it, why not give it to them? It will make them better. It will have a benefit to them. You're going to sit and say, you're a Jew, you're not a Jew, you can't have it. Why? How does that benefit the Jews? How is that, what about the non-Jews? Isn't it a good life for them? The Native Americans would find it offensive that non-Native Americans are doing the tradition because you're appropriating their forms of spirituality that they have preserved and treasured for years, and it's about them and it's about their land, and by the way, also appropriated their land and everything else. But here's a group that says, we want you to take it. You don't like it. But they want to spread it. So they aren't finding it offensive that non-Jews are in there. In fact, they find it affirming. This must be good, because non-Jews really want it.
Okay, we're going to have to move fast now, so please ask your questions quickly, because there are too many questions to get to. One, two, three, and then we'll go to this side. One, two, three. Go ahead.
Okay, so I've been there 3 times just to watch and one class. My impression was that 95% of what they do is the same as what happens in any synagogue. When I went to a Friday night service, it was the same, except they had Tikkun HaNefesh, which I know is a Jewish thing, and they had a chant for Shimon Bar Yochai. That was the only difference in the liturgy. When you walk in, they have big signs with Hebrew letters on it. In a way, that's making it much more accessible to people.
Okay, you got to come to a question. We just don't have time.
Would you agree that it's 95% consistent with what goes on in the synagogue?
In Orthodox synagogues, yes, especially Happy Minion types.
Okay, yes, number two. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was very interested in what you first started saying in terms of purity, because it seems to me that there's something in Torah that's a lot of things in Torah about purity, and that we've kind of lost it, at least in enlightened Judaism coming up in America. And
question?
The question is, can you say more about what they do about purity and why people are...
Okay, purity.
What do they do with purity? Well, again, you have to differentiate between the sort of what I call the inner core, who are more pious and observant, and people on the fringes who do less. Okay, so the inner core, men will go to mikveh every morning. If they're married, their wives will go to mikveh 7 days after their menstrual periods. Their wives will also go to mikveh during pregnancy, because it's good for you, they argue. And I'll just go other times, random times, when you feel like you need to be rejuvenated. They talk about purity in a very bizarre way, I think, in terms of how we hear, like circumcision. Jews will look at circumcision as a male baby, sign of the breed. They look at it as, and they don't go around routinely advocating circumcision, but what they'll talk about it as the foreskin, as the process of negativity and pollution. And a male with the foreskin will not have as much ability to control his sexual desire. So I know people in the center that got themselves circumcised who are not Jewish. Because I call that purity issue, in the sense that it can, and it removes that force of impurity, and they'll be able to be more sexually loyal to their wife.
back. Yes, go ahead. Oh, no, 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 no. Jules, go ahead. No, yeah.
One of the many things that made me decide not to go there anymore, but one of them my idea of Kabbalah is that it is something, it's the highest level of Judaism. Like, it's only after years of studying the Torah and being involved and being a practicing Jew that you begin to understand and grasp Kabbalah. But I was working at a volunteering open house, chop, chop, chop carrots, and I'm overhearing a missionary say, no, 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 we're not religion. Do not confuse us with Judaism. We're not connected to Judaism, only connected to them in as far as, I can't remember exactly what she said. I was really upset by that. And that was like, wait a minute, you know, you're like the utmost form of Judaism, and you're telling this woman, no, we're not religion, we're just a philosophy. Do not connect us to Judaism. Did you have any thoughts?
Yeah, I do have thoughts on that. That they are an outreach organization, and they have found that Judaism is a turnoff, and organized religion is a turnoff to people. They are seeking people who aren't affiliated generally. They aren't coming into synagogues and saying, you know, come to us instead. They sit on waiting for you to come, or they'll go out on street corners or wherever in a mall and hand out stuff. So they found that associating themselves with organized religion is not going to work for people. They also do believe that organized religion, and that includes Judaism, went astray at a certain point. It became an organized religion in a bad way, in the sense that it's about membership, it's about conformity, it's about guilt, it's about love of God, and so they don't want that association. Now, there are definitely voices within the center, and within some of the teachers, that think that that type of approach has gone way too far and is problematic. So it's not a monolithic type of, it's not just one voice that speaks that way. But you also have to understand, this is something that I learned, that there, over the centuries, there have been Kabbalists that felt that Kabbalah is so special and so important to Judaism that it's a terrible thing to keep it hidden. And that when they've seen periods when many Jews go astray or there are major disasters happening, and they'll explain that, why are these disasters happening to the Jewish people? Because God is mad at the Jewish people, because that's what it says in the Torah. If you're not following the mitzvot, then I'm going to bring all sorts of scourges upon you, and here is a scourge, so what does it mean?
But they would never say that it wasn't Jewish.
Hold on a minute. So but the Kabbalists would say, oh no, not at all. So the Kabbalists would say, the problem is we haven't been spreading Kabbalah enough. No, they would never say this isn't Jewish. I agree with you. Because they're Jewish, and they're living in a world where no one can deny they're Jewish. This is an era in which all of our boundaries are breaking. And the fact that there are boundaries breaking and there are Jews who don't want anything to do with Judaism is a good sign of that. So, and same thing, if you're gonna spread these teachings and get people to do these mitzvot, by saying you're not associated with Judaism, that's fine. But there's one thing I want to say that's very different than what the Kabbalists would say. For Kabbalah Center teachings, just doing the mitzvot, doing the ceremonies in and of themselves is not worth it. It's not worth anything. What's the point? Don't do it. If you're just following Shabbat because your father followed Shabbat, it's useless. It's not important. In that sense, the Kabbalists said that, but didn't quite mean it. And Kabbalists did say that. Just doing this without understanding the Kabbalists is understanding. It's meaningless, it's worthless, it's like straw. But they would have never thought of not doing it and of urging Jewish people not to do it. This is a different era. So in that way, it's like I kept finding these. You know, I'd come with your attitude and then I'd study it and I'd go ask another friend who's an academic scholar of Kabbalah, is this really in the Zohar? And we'd look it up and we'd find it. So in some ways, it's, in that sense, it's sort of true to a tradition, but in a different type of world, and then there's that whole marketing issue, which is heartbreaking.
We have a lot time for a last question, and then all of you can ask your questions as you're buying Professor Meyer's book. Yes, go ahead.
An Orthodox relative told me that you have to be 40 before you're able to study the Kabbalah. So are they, I mean, they're going after the younger people? Is that what the New Age system is?
You have to be 40 in order to study Kabbalah. That has actually not been, that historically has not been the ruling. It became, there was a ruling on this in the late 18th century, and that's what was decided, but it was not followed. Because some of our greatest Kabbalists were younger than 40 and started studying Kabbalah when they were teenagers. So it's one of those rules that people often did follow. Now the other thing is, you don't go into the Kabbalah Center and sit and study Zohar. You're learning sort of the ethical teachings and some of the sort of explanations about the universe and life after death and life before death that can be pulled out of it. You're not actually sitting and studying the Zohar or anything else. But if you want to, you can. You sign up for a class and you hear it and you have the Zohar there, translation, and you're doing it, and if you're under 40, you're under 40.
But there is, so in the end, I suppose, what someone outside the Kabbalah Center would find most jarring is the level of magical thinking. And that's what you would see if you were outside the religious system, although inside the religious system you might just think this is how the religious system works, right? Like Kabbalah water or scanning the Zohar even if you can't read it. All those things which to someone who doesn't think they work are magical thinking, although to them obviously it's the way Kabbalah works.
Magic is such a pejorative, but it's there. I mean, yeah, the notion that if these letters come, are, you see them, it's going to affect things. It's been part of Kabbalah also. And that's why many modern enlightened Jews said, enough of Kabbalah. It's superstitions. It's irrational. That's why it's not taught in rabbinicals. It hasn't been taught in rabbinical seminaries until the 1980s, because modern Western Jews, like you, said, I don't accept this notion that the book, the Hebrew letters, having a safer Torah necessarily will change a room and will prevent a disaster. That is part of our tradition, though, again, the others are jumping back to that magical thinking.